I've been referred to as a community activist, as an activist that works through institutions, that works politically, through the media. And do you feel that you have one definition of activism, or do you feel that over the years you've negotiated the question of what it means to be an activist in different ways?
Yeah, I don't think you can define activism only in one way or using means. If you're an activist, it's a mindset. It's something you bring to everything you do. So you're always challenging things. You're always trying to engage, intervene, and change. And whether you do it in academia or whether you do it through popular action and popular committees and so on, or through resistance or through institutional participation, official positions, although that's my least, the area of least interest to me. It's a mindset, it's an attitude, and I believe it's an integrated approach. You can't escape it. And if you have that kind of attitude, somehow it becomes your role, whatever persona you take on.
But it's one that you feel requires constant calibration and negotiation, or do you feel that it's more a question of tactic, like which is the right tactic for the moment?
It depends on the area. It depends on where you are. Of course, you have to shift tactics, and sometimes you do need to recalibrate. But basically, if you have a focus, if you know what you want. With Palestinians, we do have very clear definitions of objectives and where we're heading. So it's going to be very difficult to say, okay, now I've changed my objective or I've changed my overall scheme of things and I'm gone. No, it's just that you have to be sensitive to the most effective means and to changes around you and to be an instrument of change, to capture this and to be part of it. So in a sense, when we talk about the revolution of the 60s and 70s, people talk about armed struggle and so on. And that was the age of revolution and optimism and so on. Then when you talk about the Intifada, for example, of the late 80s, early 90s, that's where the nonviolent human spirit, institution building, civil, not disobedience, but defiance, took over, and we started the issue of democratization and so on. And with the peace process, so to speak, a very flawed one, we formulated through the Intifada the peace initiative. So in a sense, one thing flowed into the other, and we saw that we could develop a new approach or new means, and we did, and we worked collectively to get there. So the peace offensive or initiative was something we started as a result of resistance and self-confidence.
We were just talking about this before, but so what would peace mean to you today? I mean, there's the terminology of peace as we hear it today. And then there's the practice of peace that maybe you would identify as in a different way.
Yes, certainly. Or the pursuit of it. Look, the pursuit of peace in our part of the world has been so flawed, so defective, so unjust in many ways, that we run the risk of having the objective itself undermined and become suspect. To many Palestinians now, the pursuit of peace is associated with lack of even-handedness, is associated with a cover for Israel to do whatever it wants. Is a process, I will talk about this later, that has incorporated the power imbalance and has allowed the powerful to continue the victimization of the weak and so on. So we keep talking about the pursuit of peace as being flawed, the mechanism, the means and so on. It doesn't mean that the objective is any less noble. The thing is, you don't abstract it. You can't say we have an abstract objective, human, you know, global universal peace. No. We have a situation of occupation. We have a situation of dispossession and exile, and we want to resolve these. So we don't talk about conflict, because most people say, you know, peace comes at the end of the conflict. And to me, it's not a conflict. Some conflicts, of course, are very good. Conflicts are bad, but inherent in the term is a sense of parity or equality to conflicting parties. But this is a situation of victimization. And therefore, it's a Palestinian question that we need to solve. And peace to us has very clear definitions and criteria. And if we don't get there, it means that the situation of injustice has been allowed to perpetuate itself or to be perpetuated. So we're trying to regain the integrity of the term, of the objective. We're trying to regain our constituency for peace, which we have been losing regularly because the process itself was used to enable the occupier and the powerful and to victimize the people under occupation. And of course to exclude our narrative and to impose another narrative on us. I was reading, I just picked up a book by Bassem Raad, who is a colleague of mine, a friend of mine I hadn't seen in years. And on the way to the airport, a friend of mine gave it to me. And it's just, I mean, it's called Hidden Histories. Maybe I'll talk about it tonight. Palestine and the East Mediterranean. And he's trying to show how there's a process of conscious superimposition of narratives on the narrative of the indigenous, and therefore the exclusion of our story, of our reality, and the dehumanization, of course. And so he believes that any process now has to be based on unlearning what has been forcibly taught and retrieving the original meaning. And that reminds me of other writers. But anyway, so this is something that we are attempting to undo all the time in order to bring about an understanding of our narrative and our reality and our objectives. But it's very hard to pursue peace in this situation of disequilibrium.
Mm-hmm. I know that Eduardo and I have a couple of questions that have to do with literature and what role literature plays in the political goals that you're trying to move a conversation forward in regards to, the outcomes that you're working towards.
Now that you brought up this issue of the superposition of one narrative on another, I was thinking about this in relation to a couple of moments also in your book, This Side of Peace, where at one moment you refer to what you call the literature of politics. And then at another moment when the Oslo Accords are signed, and Edward says it's a compact between merchants or shopkeepers, but Darwish says that there's no place for literature in this scene. And I thought almost there's this sort of suggestion that you need to, at this point, move back to literature, return to literature, and it could be return back to the teaching of literature, but also as if there were no place for literature in the political domain. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit not only about the role and place of literature for you within that domain as a source of rhetoric, as a source of issues of representation, combating different kinds of superimposition of stories and so on, but the way in which do you see literature as a resource for you in measuring, analyzing, countering different representations, let's say, of the Palestinians and so on.
Absolutely. I think inherent in your question is an answer, basically. No, I think there is an essential room for literature. I think politics without literature is really lost. It doesn't have a soul, and it lost touch with its human substance. And I believe literature restores or gives it this human substance and, of course, awareness and so on, and the human narrative itself, and personalizes it, doesn't abstract it. Unfortunately, this is a rarity. It is a rarity because politics, as we know it, is a domain of it. It's two-dimensional. It's flat. It's power. It's quite often deceptive. It's self-serving, and so on. So all the negative things we can talk about in terms of politics exist. But along with that is a challenging voice. I think of Edward and Mahmoud as being immersed in the politics of Palestine, but without being politicians. And the same thing with me. I mean, we don't have the choice. We talked about this over lunch. You never have the choice as a Palestinian to say, I'm staying outside this domain, and I have the luxury of sitting back, doing my research, discussing, you know, theories and ideas, and I don't have to influence my reality, or I don't have to be part of it. You have to be part of it. I think you can see that in the Madrid speech. Those of you who've read the Madrid speech. I wrote that speech personally. There are many people tried to...
It's a very moving speech.
Because I wrote it from the heart.
Yeah.
I had to add a few political points, but basically it was a speech in which I saw it as the coming out of the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. And we had to have the language, the tone, the engagement, the terms of reference that are inclusive, that could create shared understandings rather than exclude us mm-hmm. once again. So I didn't want the jargon of politics. I didn't want the slogans. I didn't want the posturing and so on. And I said it has to be an honest statement from the heart, mm-hmm. and it has to be literary mm-hmm. because this is how I feel literature can challenge mm-hmm. and can expose flat discourse mm-hmm. and deceptive messages. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, somehow you claim your own terrain. mm-hmm. And I did that. I felt that the Madrid speech was very, very important. So mm-hmm. I describe mm-hmm. in my book how I prepared another speech for Arafat to give on the White House lawn, and they refused it. They mm-hmm. absolutely, they said, this is an important occasion, and Arafat is not a poet. So you don't give him the speech. And somebody else sat down and wrote the most reductive, politically, I don't want to call it insulting, but just a speech that did everything I didn't want to do
yeah.
in terms of repeating the slogan. And it didn't convey the humanity of the Palestinians. It didn't have the creativity. It didn't have the foresight. It didn't have also the recognition. I said, you have to. This is your platform. You have to recognize your own people. Mm-hmm. And you have to, if you don't recognize them, how will the world recognize them? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you have to talk about your people and what they've gone through and how we've managed to create this breakthrough mm-hmm. and to mm-hmm. move on. And unfortunately, that wasn't read. I have to find where it is. I guess I lost it. Mm-hmm. But literature to me is part of my reality, of who I am. Mm-hmm. And the language I use, and I said when they signed the Oslo agreement, I said there's no room
yes.
for people like me or my language, because now all those people who were excluded, who were pariahs, so to speak, who were not recognized, want their day in the sun. Mm-hmm. And this is their language, their approach, not mine. Mm-hmm. We're the people who lived with the people. We're the people who are basically not the political leadership, but the people, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And so our narrative, our language was not the language of the moment, mm-hmm. even in negotiations. Mm-hmm. So we made room for the excluded and denied. Okay, let them do it their way, and we'll see. But unfortunately, all our worst expectations mm-hmm. came to being. It's very sad. But to me, literature is part of the struggle. It is part of the affirmation of humanity we mm-hmm. were talking about. Mm-hmm. It is part of this awareness that you need, this interconnectedness, mm-hmm. the sense that there is substance, there is a reality, not just to the narrow day-to-day things and political manipulations and language of power and self-interest, but that there's a much larger scope for peace, for humanity, for whatever, without it being an abstraction, but as a reality that mm-hmm. you can grasp.
And also, I guess, because for you, the literature bears the traces of a memory and a culture and a language and a history of the people, so that it's not, when you say it's not something related to the day-to-day activities, it's something that has to do with the memory and history of the
memory,
people.
Memory, history, validation of the culture.
Yes.
It's a culture that's been so rudely denied and distorted and maligned, and, as well as the people. I mean, of course, the pain of a people is important. Mm-hmm. And you have to capture it and present it in a way that would reach the others and that can be remedial. Mm-hmm. It's not just exhibitionistic, look, you know, I'm suffering, but it's what have I done with this? What mm-hmm. can I do with mm-hmm. it to move ahead? That's why I put in the Madrid speech that, you know, we as people under occupation, as the victims, we're the ones who are reaching out and saying, we will make peace, because mm-hmm. it takes confidence and strength to make mm-hmm. peace. Mm-hmm. Very easy to resort to violence. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the whole collective utterance mm-hmm. has to be presented through the individual. I don't know if we are. You cannot bring a whole nation to say this is what I have to do. Mm-hmm. You have to be in tune with the whole nation, mm-hmm. with your culture, with mm-hmm. your with the people who went with us to the bridge, you know, right. to say goodbye. These are the people whose language, whose message you're carrying. And therefore you have to do it with honesty.
Yes. And when you use that language, you're not using a language that is simply yours.
No, exactly.
So it's exactly that.
It is, in a sense, the collective, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. because that's what gave you the strength, the courage, the depth, and perhaps the authenticity. Mm-hmm. Because you're not there to serve your own interests. You're not mm-hmm. there for a political system mm-hmm. or government or governance. You're there to say, we have a clear human message, mm-hmm. and it is understandable, and it has to be understood, because for so long we have been excluded. We've mm-hmm. been outside in the cold, so mm-hmm. to speak.
And it's for this reason, then, that perhaps that you don't associate so much with the politician as much as with the activist, in a way? Is this why maybe before you seem to resist being thought of as a politician? In
yes.
a way? It's partly because...
I still do. I yeah. don't like official political positions. Mm-hmm. I once accepted to be Minister of Higher Education and Research because of specific conditions. And then I accepted to be nominated and to run for the PLO Executive Committee, which also has a very specific objective. But I've never thought of myself as an official. I don't like officialdom. I don't like being an official. And I like being independent. It's very, very selfish. but to be independent means you have the freedom mm-hmm. to speak out, mm-hmm. to criticize, to engage when you want, to disengage when you don't want, and to, which is what Edward did. I mean, you're mm-hmm. able to speak out. I hate that, I mean, truth to power and so on, but mm-hmm. you are able to challenge. And this is very important. If you lose that, if you get co-opted, if you become part of a system of power or a system of domination or a system of self-interest, then you're done for. You have no credibility. Mm-hmm. And your influence, your impact is diminished as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's remarkable how many institutions you're involved in, at the same time how you've maintained your integrity. and this is something that's very difficult to do.
Yes.
I don't know if there's a question here, but... But the institute, you know, the...
I'm being a troublemaker. It's my job. I am a troublemaker, actually. And not everything I say pleases, you know, official. Mm-hmm. I go out and demonstrate when there are problems. I went out with the young, and even when people were saying we cannot be, you know, seen as part of the this or that, and Mubarak and Ben Ali, and I said, no, this is our job. We are the people. Mm-hmm. who have started a revolution. We are the people who are supposed to be the voice of the people. And if we start playing this diplomatese and we're reticent and so mm-hmm. on, and we don't express the excitement at this new spirit, mm-hmm. then we are selling our own people, our own revolution short. So I did go out and I did demonstrate and I did issue statements and it's part of who I am. So whatever I do, and I belong in civil society more than in... Mm-hmm. officialdom. I bring that to my work, regardless. It doesn't please everybody. And it does challenge the official version. mm-hmm. But it's okay. It's okay. That's always been my job. I mean, from the beginning, even when they started establishing the Palestinian National Authority, it was always my job to ensure that there is accountability, that there is oversight, that they are aware of what they're doing to a people who have been traumatized for so long. Because they saw themselves as systems of power. I saw them as supposedly, you know, the vindication of struggle for us and the service of the people. Anyway, so that's why I don't mind being a troublemaker or an activist wherever I am. And I like building institutions. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to institutionalize because that's how we resisted mm-hmm. the deconstruction, the dismantlement of mm-hmm. Palestine. Mm-hmm. And it was a battle of wills with the Israelis from the mm-hmm. beginning. Mm-hmm. We build our institutions, we manage our own system of decision-making and so on. We challenge the imposed orders, military orders or decisions by the Israelis. That's how we maintained our spirit, our integrity, our defiance. But now, unfortunately, the peace process has done a lot to undermine that as a process, not as peace itself.
Mm-hmm. I know we've been talking about literature. I was wondering if we could also talk about art more generally. Last December, I was in Ramallah, visited Art School Palestine, which is this extraordinary school in Ramallah.
The academy? Yeah.
Extraordinary. I don't know if there's a question here again, but what role does culture play, and is that kind of a place that more work needs to be done in?
Yes, mm-hmm. and needs to be recognized. Mm-hmm. You've been to Ramallah, you see that we have cultural activities every night, more than one. Mm-hmm. And people say, I mean, look, this must be a luxury. The Palestinians mm-hmm. of Ramallah have all these cultural activities, they have nothing better to do. And we say, this is life. Mm-hmm. This is what we're doing. You know, my sister is a pianist. She's one of those who established the Edward Said music conservatoire, but it's conservatory, but it was the National Conservatory of Music before. Mm-hmm. Mariam insisted it should be Edward Said. Mm-hmm. My husband worked in theater and music, and he's a photographer as well as my. I should show you some mm-hmm. of his mm-hmm. photographs. Yeah, amazing. And there are lots of this is, before it used to be seen as the literature of resistance, the culture of resistance. Mm-hmm. But then it became more than that. It mm-hmm. evolved to become, you know, the culture of affirmation, of life, mm-hmm. of Palestinian reality. It was much more than just an instrument, a tool. Mm-hmm. It became a source of validation and self-definition. And it's amazing. It's amazing, the vitality, the spirit. That's why when Hamas tried to prevent the dabke and the singing and so on, that's where it lost elections, in the places where it decided to outlaw those things that are part of our identity. I said, this is folklore. Mm-hmm. When they decided to censor a book, Sing Bird Sing, you know, because they said there was some sexual allusions. But this is our language. This is our folklore. So in a sense, they invalidated themselves by attempting to censor, to control these impulses in people. I mean, people dance the dabke all the time. You cannot tell them you can't have men and women dancing or music is against religion. This is part of the celebration of life that we have. And it's part of our identity. And all these activities are to us a statement that the Palestinians are still alive mm-hmm. and healthy mm-hmm. and have not given up, have not surrendered. And these are not just tools, but they are part of this drive mm-hmm. for freedom, for human dignity, which is now mm-hmm. being seen currently. It's not just going out into the streets and protesting mm-hmm. and having sit-ins and so on. It is the ability to maintain this kind of creativity and sanity. That's very important. Because if we lose it and we become just victims, it's really not a very healthy sign.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you emphasized that, because I remember at one point thinking that one of the few true things that the Elder Bush said when they went into Iraq was, this is not a war against the Iraqi people. And I thought this was true, because it was always only a war against tropes of the Iraqi people, because the U.S. knew nothing about the Iraqi people. Absolutely. It knew it couldn't name a philosopher, a poet, a filmmaker. It couldn't name any of these things. So, of course, this has everything to do with not knowing or not taking the time to know and understand this culture.
Such, so. I call it, talk about this cultural astigmatism when it comes mm-hmm. to the U.S. and what it's doing with our part of the world. Mm-hmm. That's why I think Bassem Raad's new book that I'm reading is very exciting. Mm-hmm. I think is a very important corrective force. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've never seen such ignorance in decision makers. Yeah. They don't understand the nuances, the culture, the language, even in setting up a peace process. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What they did was they postponed all the crucial issues, all the causes of the conflict.
the settlements and
The Jerusalem, the settlements, the borders, and so on. And they said, let's solve these technical issues that can be solved. Why? Mm-hmm. You solve the big issues, the occupation itself, and then everything else technically will fall in place. Mm-hmm. When we were in the 1980s, there was a military governor called Menachem Milson, and he had an assistant called Igal Carmon, who used to question us all the time. Now he has one of those vicious sort of institutions that he monitors everything that's in the Arab world. You know Memri? M-E-M-R-O-I. It's one of the worst institutions. They find if there's some deranged cleric somewhere in some village who said something against the Jews, and they come and say, you see, all Palestinians are anti-Semitic. Or somebody. And it goes to Congress and everywhere, and then everywhere I go, I am asked to respond to such idiocy. Mm-hmm. And it's such a waste of time. Mm-hmm. Anyway. So he used to be an interrogator, and he was Shamir's counterterrorism expert. So Menachem Milson decided that they're going to have what they call the civil administration. Mm-hmm. And they invited us to the civil administration to take over, to run our lives under occupation. And of course we said no. So we can run our schools, we do. We can collect our garbage, we do. We run our hospitals, we do. But you're the occupying power. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be in your employ. We are not functionaries of the occupation. What we want is freedom from the occupation. So you leave, and we will take over. Mm-hmm. But we will not be your administrators, so to speak. So they became the civil administration, the Israelis. They had the military governor and the civil administration and so on. So in the peace process, they accepted in the accords that were signed less than what we were offered under occupation, and we rejected because we didn't want the functional approach, the administrative. We said we want the territorial approach. We want the freedom of the land. And that's the basic flaw. There are many flaws in the peace process. That's why... what's the question? We were talking about function.
Well, we were talking about the centrality of culture, art, history.
We're talking about actually
and
something
the
more
ignorance,
practical.
The ignorance.
Yeah, the ignorance, exactly. So they thought they were bringing something enormous to us. Mm-hmm. Look, you know, you're going to take charge of this and that and schools and hospitals. And we said, we do that anyway. And we were offered to become civil administrators, and we refused. So that shows... I use that as an example, the lack of understanding, not just of the culture, but of the simplest realities of our lives and of what's important. And I said, if you superimpose the American mindset on our culture, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. We don't think like Americans. We don't behave like Americans. We don't act like Americans. So don't think that this is how, if you remove all our cultural values and sense of identity, you're not going to solve anything in this peace process. So we're not going to be very happy if you give us a few confidence-building measures or the quality of life argument. It's the question of freedom. It's the question of the recognition of the Palestinian identity and rights. That's it. And it's if they had done it that way, fine. But instead... And they didn't understand really how our culture works. They didn't understand the history, the depth of the Iraqi, Babylonian culture. And the same way as people don't understand the Palestinian linkage to the land itself and to the Canaanites and before. And why are we so adamant that we are deep-rooted and ancient and so on? Because we're being uprooted and we're being denied and negated. And this doesn't figure in their own paradigm and their own approach.
Many questions. I know we don't have much time. I was reading one of your speeches last night, and I think it was, if I'm remembering correctly, for the Jerusalem Fund, if that makes, if that's right. Too simple. And
long time ago, maybe.
Yeah. And and you talked about the issue that we don't have the luxury of being non-engaged, or that in a way we're always implicated. Mm-hmm. And I, if I was reading you correctly, you were not just talking about the Palestinians. You were talking about, in a more collective way, you were talking about all of us.
As humanity, you mean?
Yeah. And is that something that you would feel today? I mean, I ask this because in the Peace Project we've been returning to Immanuel Kant's writings, and he makes this argument in 1795 that injustice in one part of the earth is felt all over it.
All over, yes. Mm-hmm.
Such mm-hmm. that one is always implicated by virtue of having felt that injustice. Yeah. Would you say this? Would you?
No, we cannot afford not to be mm-hmm. involved, not to be engaged, and because we are implicated, especially if we, you know, sit it out and watch it work mm-hmm. work itself out.
Right. But without regard to geography, we're all implicated in a way.
Well, we are. Of course, there's a common humanity and there are common values. I really don't like the concept that these human rights or issues are culture biased. Mm-hmm. I believe that they apply to everybody. Mm-hmm. And some of our regimes have been saying, well, these are Western, so we don't, or these contradict the teachings of our religion and blah. Now, these are excuses to avoid recognition of these rights. No, there is a common humanity, I agree, but whatever happens, there is a ripple effect everywhere. Unfortunately, it's not the humanist or the artist or the writer who immediately grasps this, but the politician who tries to see what is this going to have an impact on the price of oil, for example, or the stock market, or whatever, rather than, you know, this is an injustice that can become a wound that festers and that can continue, and it is my responsibility to do something about it. You don't expect them to become all altruists and so on. But at the same time, I don't expect to see the manipulation of Kant in the way that people like Sharansky did. I was so angry when this. Mm-hmm. Well, democracies don't wage war against each other. And so we have to wait till all the Arab countries become democratic, and then we will make peace. Because they're not worthy of peace. I was just astounded.
Yeah.
I was astounded. First of all, we as Palestinians are under occupation. Israel describes itself as the only democracy in the region. And democracies don't enslave other people. Mm-hmm. They don't create such a complex and intricate system of discrimination and so on. They don't use violence against a whole nation. They don't imprison them. Anyway, so to say that, again, the Palestinians are not democratic, so we'll have, and from a very patronizing point of view, so we'll have to wait and see if they're worthy of peace or to be talked to. The thing is, there's no parity again. We are under occupation. We could have been democratic a long time ago. Mm-hmm. We actually were under occupation. Mm-hmm. We, in spite of all the negative intervention in our lives, we manage to create systems that are democratic. We manage to create accountable systems and so on. And we worked hard and we paid the price for that. But to say that we're not worthy of freedom or peace because we're not democratic, or that the Arab countries are not democratic, so they're subhuman and so on.
You're here to give the memorial lecture for Saeed, and we were just wondering, because you did refer to him just a little while ago in relation to Mahmoud also, that they were resources for you in terms of your own relation to literature. Could you say a little bit more about your relation to Edward?
Well, both Edward and Mahmoud I consider friends of mine.
Yes.
Both passed away and both left a very, very big vacuum, really a major gap in our lives and our culture and our utterance. Anyway, I first met Edward when I was a student at AUB. Mm-hmm. He had just written, I think, Beginnings. When did he write that one?
It would have been the early 80s, was it?
Or no,
was
before.
Late 70s?
Was it before.
The 70s, I think, yeah.
The late 60s, early 70s,
was it
something?
Early?
I think so. Yeah. Anyway, he had come to visit AUB and he gave a talk, and I was very proud. Mm-hmm. That there was a Palestinian who's gaining recognition and who's coming. We always get foreigners, we always get, you know, big minds, but here's Edward, who's coming to give us a talk on history of ideas, literary mm-hmm. theory, and so on. And it was the beginning of a sense of identification. Mm-hmm. Whatever a Palestinian does to me is something that mm-hmm. would elevate our cause and make it more understandable to the rest of the world. So that's when I first met him. And then when I came back after years, I started writing. I wrote something about Palestinian literature, and I was very critical of the fact that they reduce literature, our writers, to mm-hmm. an instrument, and they don't pay attention to the aesthetics, to the mm-hmm. quality, and that it's just a question of, is it Palestinian, is it nationalistic, mm-hmm. therefore it's good. Mm-hmm. Anything else is, you know, extraneous, is not to be judged as literature. So I wrote something critical, and he wrote and he said he is delighted that somebody can be critical of Palestinian mm-hmm. literature. You're mm-hmm. breaking a taboo, he said, the mm-hmm. fact that we always forgive ourselves because mm-hmm. our trespasses, because we measure things only in relation mm-hmm. to the political or the resistance aspect, but that to be in the resistance you have to have also the depth, the quality, the aesthetics, mm-hmm. everything. You cannot just reduce it to that level. So he wrote about that, and I think he had an allusion in one of his books. When I was writing my dissertation, we needed an external reader, and he volunteered. So he was on my examination committee and an external reader on my dissertation. Mm-hmm. And we stayed in touch, and we wrote, we talked. I saw him whenever I came to the States, and, you know, we mm-hmm. would see each other. And I asked him to be on many boards of institutions that I'd set up, and he was. He accepted kindly. We had an ongoing conversation. And I felt Edward was a force. Mm-hmm. I felt he could do so much, not just for the Palestinians, but for the humanity of mm-hmm. the Palestinians and for the history of ideas and so on. And we didn't show the appreciation needed, you know? Mm-hmm. And we didn't embrace this kind of thinker. And at the same time, there were attempts to reduce him, to turn him into a politician, and to define him within a movement or a party. And I felt that was so unfair, because he was much more than that. And the same with Mahmoud Darwish. Mahmoud is a universalist in his poetry, but he also embodies the essence of the Palestinian experience and identity, and he's not ashamed of it, and he's out there. Edward is a much more complex reality, his own sense. He was, I talk about this, his restlessness, his restless spirit, I think. And he had this dynamic, this tension with his own identity as a Palestinian, mm-hmm. with his own people. Mm-hmm. And he felt that he could make a difference, and he had to intrude. But quite often he was quite naive when it came to the political intricacies of what was happening. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But he was much more creative and astute mm-hmm. than the politicians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was Saeed a model for you in a way? Or was he someone that you looked to for guidance as to how to navigate the life that you've led as a public intellectual in a way? Or not necessarily, was that not...
Not that consciously, maybe, not that mm-hmm. consciously. No, I never took on models in a conscious way. Uh-huh. I mean, you are, after all, everything you've read and all the people you've seen and all the, you know, different forces that affected you, altered your course a bit, mm-hmm. Charted a different course and so on. Everybody is affected. So I guess I'm very eclectic. I think Edward was instrumental in many ways. And I think we also influenced Edward mm-hmm. in other ways. Mm-hmm. So it's a two-way street. But he certainly helped in terms of understanding, I don't say understanding, but seeing firsthand an intellectual who, and an artist and a creative person who felt that he was in this world here and now, and that he had a responsibility, and this responsibility of creativity and the mind and the intellect is one that we take very seriously. But when that is translated into narrow politics, it doesn't work. You have to challenge, you have to be greater than that, and you have to challenge it, and you have to be the corrective force on politics, and you have to question always. And so he did that, and I appreciated that very much, and I felt that that was important. So in that sense, yes, you could say he was a mentor, and I look upon him as one. But I don't believe in theory of models. They're very static. We're always interacting. Mahmoud Darwish, in a sense, his poetry is also very, very revealing to me, to many Palestinians. I taught his poetry, and I felt that he also challenged in a different way the way we use language and the way we view ourselves and our relations to others and then our own matter.
Forgive me if this question is naive, but within the context of the Peace Project, we've been thinking a great deal about the question of the apology and questions of forgiveness.
Yeah, and it's very important.
Could you speak to this? I mean, as one who's lived under occupation, advocating for those that live under an occupation, what does apology and forgiveness kind of mean? Is it possible?
It's the beginning of peace. It's the first step. It's a sine qua non, I believe. Really. I said once that it's not enough to trust each other. You don't need to trust each other to make peace. It's okay. Peace will come when you change the conditions. Trust will come when you change the conditions that produced the distrust and the hostility and the anger and so on. But it's essential to have an apology and to have a recognition of the victimization of the other. You see, this is particularly true when it comes to the Palestinian refugees, because their narrative has been denied. I mean, look, we have, 518 villages totally razed, destroyed completely. And these people, you know, find their heritage is gone. Their physical domain is finished. And their narrative is denied. They were told they left at the behest of the Arab leaders when they were terrorized. Now the truth is coming out. But they were terrorized, they were expelled, there were massacres. And it's not enough that they lost the land, they lost their development, their growth, their relationship, their community, their safety. They also were denied in terms of their own narrative. Mm-hmm. And they're told that the only good Palestinian is the Palestinian who denies the right of return. Because the right of return equals destroying the state of Israel. So they've become sort of a touchstone of whether peace is possible. And I say no. First of all, you start by recognizing their narrative, acknowledging it, their suffering. And Israel has to acknowledge the fact that they did dispossess, uproot, displace the Palestinian refugees, that they have to admit culpability and guilt and responsibility. And that's the first step. Then you start saying, well, the refugees have legal rights, like everybody else. There are international laws and there are resolutions. And so you cannot say, if you qualify to be an interlocutor, then you have to abandon these rights. No, these rights exist. And after that, the third step, then you start looking at solutions in concrete terms and options. But to exclude them from the human narrative, from the recognition of their very real and ongoing suffering, and then exclude them from the protection of the law, of course, which is what happened to all of us, and then say we can make peace. No, you can't. It's not just the truth and reconciliation of South Africa, and I've seen what they did, and I talked to many of them. I think it goes beyond that. It goes to the sense that I have dehumanized you, denied your humanity and your rights for so long to give myself license to do whatever I want to you. And the beginning of the unraveling of this is by recognizing that. And therefore I would draw the license I have given myself to constantly oppress, humiliate, distort, and so on. So it's absolutely essential. That goes a long way, I think, and the Palestinians have always wanted this. Mm-hmm. That's why they embrace the new historians, even though many of them... Look, it's not Tom Segev, who is it, who started the... He started the... He wrote the first book on based on the intelligence archives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you remember his mm-hmm. name?
I don't remember his name.
It's not Segev, it's somebody else who... Mm-hmm. I'll remember, it'll come back to me anyway. And he... maybe it's Freudian, I've forgotten, because we were so happy that mm-hmm. the new historians are exposing mm-hmm. the truth based on the intelligence archives. But then recently he came out and he said the problem is not the ethnic cleansing, it's not the killing and the expulsion and so on, as I said, that it's the fact that Israel did not complete it, which has created mm-hmm. the problem now. Had they completed, had they kicked out all the Palestinians, then there would have been no problem now.
It's an amazing line.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that really, because... We embraced this, the new historian. We said, well, they're coming out because they have access. We don't have access. Now they've closed down the archives, as you know, once again, Israel has done that. So we need this validation. If there is to be a redemptive process, if there is to be a real reconciliation, then it has to start with this recognition, acknowledgement, validation, the apology, and move from there. I was amazed in Australia, for example, it took them so long.
Yes.
So long they
the
resisted.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And the Aboriginals needed this apology. It was essential. And it is a first step. Because if you insist that what you've done is right, and if you refuse to acknowledge this guilt, mm-hmm. then you have license to continue and perpetuate it. And there's no reason to have peace. Mm-hmm. That's why I believe it's essential. And in the same way, I believe if we've done something wrong, even as victims, we have to acknowledge it from the beginning. Even if we understand why and who and the reasons and the causes and so on. But if you believe it's wrong, you have to have the courage to say so. But the Palestinians, I think, sooner or later, will get, I think, a global apology because... everybody's been complicit in this. It's not. It's not just the Israelis. It's not. It's the Arab world. It's the Israelis, but it's the whole world basically, and it's the community of nations that has found it very convenient to support Israel and to provide it with a legal cover, and to dismiss the Palestinians.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.